attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. This week, we donned a high-vis vest, chugged some Lucozade, and tried really hard not to twang a hammy, all in order to impress Karen Dobre, one of the sporting world's most genuine game changers. Co-founder of Equality FC and the Sistership Network, Karen is a champion for equal playing budgets, equal facilities, and basically equal everything between men's and women's sports teams. She's also been a key figure in the Call Him Out initiative and has even helped with the installation of a statue celebrating bisexual female pirates. Quite possibly the busiest person in the sports world, Karen writes for a number of leading publications, has served as a judge on the UN Women UK Awards, managed a counselling service at PolyGram Records, and is a former director at Lewis FC, the world's first and only equal football club. During that time, Karen said, "We're trying to do football differently, and that makes us different, and it makes us attract different people." Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you so much, Giles. I'm very happy to be here.
Good stuff. Right, seven quick fire questions. We start easy. Tea or coffee?
Tea, definitely.
Modelling or counselling?
Counselling.
Non-league or Champions League?
Non-league.
Nice. Karen Brady or Karen Carney?
Karen Carney.
Three more. The Booker Prize or the Rooker Prize?
The Rooker Prize.
For the win. Two more. Bradley Walsh or Bradley Pritchard?
Oh, Bradley Pritchard every day.
That was a tap in. Right. And last one. Bitch Invasion or Pitch Invasion?
Bitch Invasion, although Amazon prefers Pitch Invasion.
I've noticed that in the research. It's funny. Google Books is happy with Bitch. And obviously Amazon with the latter. Fair enough.
Yeah, they only like it for female dogs, really, at this stage in the word's development.
Fair enough. We'll get there. Listen, Karen, thank you so much for joining us. We always start the show to ask guests about their path to where they are now, and yours is fascinating and as wiggly as the best of them. So can you start by telling our audience about your first ever job and then what you regard to be your first proper job?
Yes, of course. So my first ever job was when I was 14 and I got a job after school in Ravel Shoe Shop. And I loved it because I got a 33% discount on shoes and bags. And so did all my family and friends. It was so funny. We loved it. Yeah, so we made really good use of that. And I worked there, I think, three evenings a week after school and Saturdays as well, just to earn some money, you know. And then my first proper job between school and university, I went to Germany, mainly just to get away from my family, and because I'd done German A level, you know, I was in a flat with these members of the Green Party, and it was all very exciting because they were all in their 30s and I was 18. I got a job as a waitress, and then I got a job with Otsuka Pharmaceutical, a Japanese pharmaceutical company, who initially just wanted someone with mother tongue English to check pharmaceutical clinical trials reports, that they were in the proper English language because they were done by Japanese or German professors. And it was just temporary because someone was in hospital. But then whilst I was there, they actually needed a London office. And they said, "Oh, you're from London, buy us a London office." So,
wow.
Yeah. And I was 18 and it was brilliant. They kind of flew me business class back and forth from Frankfurt to London with these specifications of what the office needed to be. It needed to be near Heathrow. It needed to have a certain amount of capacity. And they wanted a British Racing green Rolls Royce, as I remember, and gave me cash in a suitcase handcuffed to my wrist to go and buy one in London. I mean, it was just crazy, really. And all my friends, you know, I was getting taxis everywhere when I was in London, and it was all very impressive. And they ended up sponsoring me through university to do English literature, which was unheard of because they're a pharmaceutical company, right? But to say thank you, because I bought them this office in King Street in Hammersmith, if anyone knows it, still there today, called Otsuka House, you know, kitted it all out for them. And it was just great fun. So that's yeah, amazing. That was my first proper job.
So normally, you said you were around about 18. Normally that people are sent out to buy tartan paint and skyhooks at that age. That's quite the story.
You know, I've always been up for things, Giles. I've always said yes to things and thought, you know, why not? I mean, I'm as good as anyone else. And if I give it a try, you know, I might just get it right. And always ask people for help, always. So, you know, that's what I've did then, and that's what I still do, to be fair.
Nice. Yeah. There's the consistent thread that I always look for, Karen, when I interview people. So yeah. Prior to that then, and I think I know the answer, but did you have any preset ideas of where your career might go?
I wanted to be a journalist, actually. I'd always liked writing at school, and I'd gone to a school which was in a very multicultural area of Northwest London, and it'd been in the borough of Brent, and we'd had anti-racism conferences organised by Ken Livingstone, our MP, and I'd been the reporter back, you know, for those conferences, and really enjoyed it. So when I went to university, I started to edit a magazine there, and afterwards I thought, well, I'll go on to be a journalist, but I just didn't do anything about it. So when I left university, I was scouted by a model agent, actually. I didn't have any money. So I thought, well, I'll join the model agency because that's what's in front of me. And that's how I earned money for a year or two initially, and then again later in a career break.
Yeah, that's incredible. So I've got here that you've worked for fashion designers, including Vivienne Westwood and a couple of others, which I won't try to pronounce because I'll demonstrate how clumsy and ignorant I am. But it's an impressive read.
It's amazing when something that you don't like about yourself, which in my case was being lanky, tall and skinny, becomes an asset and you are suddenly able to earn money from it. So, it was very useful for me. And I did that for a year or so before working for Northcliffe Newspapers in the sales department. So selling newspapers into newsagents and just writing up newsagent of the week, which I really liked writing up. But whilst I was there, a friend of mine took his own life and I went to the Samaritans. I really benefited from that session and trained to be a Samaritan and started to steward the phones. And I realised I liked that better than the day job. So I went back to London to train to be a counsellor and then went back to modelling again to pay for the counselling tuition, which was, you know, expensive. So I had this double life really for a few years where I was indeed walking catwalks for Vivienne Westwood and Hussein Chalai and Ali Kakalino and all these amazing designers, but then doing my counselling course and also seeing clients voluntarily one day a week. Yeah, and then I eventually got the job with Polygram Records, setting up their internal counselling service, which was very useful that I'd been a fashion model because they're, you know, fashion and music industries, similar problems, if you like, with easy access to drugs and alcohol and, you know, long distance relationships to navigate. That was the kind of pathway into counselling in the music business. I called Samaritans because I'd just moved to Essex to work with the Essex Chronicle when my friend died. And I didn't know where to turn. I didn't know anyone there. And they actually said, come and have a cup of tea, and which was the kindest thing. And I went to see them and they were so kind and I, you know, loved them for it. And then they offered me the most amazing 12-week training with real actors coming in. And it's the best training I've ever done. And I've done lots of counselling trainings to really listen.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's incredible. And as you say, the parallels between the world that you had experience in modelling is no doubt shares similar experiences and highs and lows of the music industry. How long did you work with Polygram then? And was that department, once you'd set up, presumably that's still something that is in place?
So what happened was I set it up with a colleague called Melissa, who then went to Rape Crisis, actually, because she moved to Dublin. And then I was on my own there. You know, we were serving all these different record labels, plus the people that packed CDs and the people in HR, you know, everywhere on all the different sites. I was there, I think, for about 6 years. Then I left because I went to maternity leave and didn't go back in the end, but I carried on a private practice. And it was a colleague that I'd met who'd previously worked in another kind of in-house counselling service, took it over. Then Polygram was bought by Universal. So I don't know where it went from there, whether they kept an internal service or they went to an employee assistance program. I don't know. But I think the internal one was really good because you could really understand the industry and the kinds of people that were there and their, you know, had that easy access and explain the confidentiality really well. So yeah, it was great. I really enjoyed that period of my life.
Amazing. And if we've not had enough variety already, you trod the, I'm going to say the well-trodden path, but somewhat sarcastically, of catwalks to counselling to football. I've heard you say football and sport weren't on your radar, and yet that's where you ended up.
I never liked football because I was, as I said, I was in the London Borough of Brent growing up quite near Wembley. And when I wanted to get on the tube, sometimes there were, you know, beery blokes,
yeah,
kind of shouting, and you felt as a teenager, as a girl, quite vulnerable, really, sometimes. Then I'd gone to a match because my cousin had played for Brentford when I was 14, 15, and I'd had the experience of being harassed, really, at the match. And I thought, well, this isn't for me. This is just lots of men who want to drink and shout. And that was my opinion of football. And it wasn't helped by all the front pages, you know, in the sort of 80s as I was growing up, of kind of hooliganism or footballers in jacuzzis with just wags. You know, that was women's place in football. So it was a wag. So just an accessory, you know, to the main event. So I'd always just steered clear of football and not thought it was anything to do with me, you know. And if I heard it on the telly, boring, you know, really boring, just switch it off or go in the other room. But of course, I married a massive football fan. And when we moved to Lewis, we moved here 18 years ago, he immediately became a fan of Lewis FC. And when Lewis FC was on the brink of financial ruin in 2009, he and five other fans bought it for £1, paid off the debts and mutualized it so that it became community owned and anyone could own it. In fact, you know, it still is. You can just pay £50 a year and own Lewis Football Club. And for that, you get to vote in directors, you get one single share, and you can stand to be a director as well. In 2016, he said to me, what would you say? Because you're a feminist, I've always, you know, been a feminist. What would you say if we said we were going to pay the women the same as the men? And I said, what? You mean women play football? Because I honestly didn't know.
Yeah.
I know, that's how green I was. And women play football and you don't pay them the same as the men? What's going on, right? Because bear in mind, I came from fashion where women probably earned more than men. And, you know, therapy where I'd been paid well, the same scale as any manager at Polygram. I was hearing that women not only didn't get paid the same as men, but often had to pay to play, you know, back in 2017. I went to see a women's match and it wasn't at all what I imagined football was. In fact, it blew me away. It was like an epiphany. I saw these amazing women, young women, in a public place, you know, being strong and focused and powerful and working as a team and, you know, completely going against this kind of sexist presentation that we have of women as ornaments in the larger world and on social media. And I just thought, I want my daughter to see this. I want my son to see this. I want my friends to see this. Why aren't there more people here? Because there were only like 100 people or so at the ground. And, you know, the men's matches at that point attracted, you know, many more, like 500 to 600 people. This is way back in 2017. So I got into football via the equality route, which is an unusual route, because I wanted people to know, people like me, to understand that they weren't welcome to football, that women had been deliberately banned from football, and that's why I didn't know about it, and that there were many other women like me that could come and support these women, could get into women's football and, you know, be a new market for it. And so prove to critics of equality in football that women deserved the same as men if they came, if we got all these crowds through the gate, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So how did you first start getting involved, like, more officially with the club?
Well, I mean, at that point in the club's history, there were a couple of women on the board, and neither of them, you know, one of them was an operations manager and one of them was into the, you know, also the facilities and things like that. And they weren't communicators. I, you know, suddenly getting very angry about something I'd never even known about a few weeks before, the plight of women in football. I said I volunteered to go and tell women's groups about what Lewis FC were doing and that they needed to come and support these female footballers in order for the Equality FC project to work. So I kind of did it very methodically. I made lists of women's groups in locally in Lewis, in Brighton, and also some in London, and went to tell them this story and about the history of women's football and why this beginnings of a movement really needed support. And I kind of then officially became, I think, volunteer press officer and then, you know, started to think of activations that once these women came to the football matches, that they would enjoy the environment at a football match. And effectively, I feminized the environment at Lewis FC. Our ground is called the Dripping Pan. We have a statue of female pirates from the 18th century whose story is undertold, and they face the direction of the sea and they look at the women playing. And we got that for free, of course, from an amazing sculptor. We have a massive pop art installation of a female eye to try and imagine new utopias for football through the female perspective rather than the male gaze. We have two gardens there, one vegetable garden, one flower garden. We have breastfeeding facilities. We have more female toilets than male. We have all sorts of vegan and as well as, you know, your average options for, you know, so we changed the environment gradually to welcome this new market for women's football. Time, weather, and
we interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V, Sunshine. Here we go.
Did the diversity of crowds change almost immediately? And how did they change with the men's team as well? Did you start introducing an audience to both teams, or did you mostly see change one side?
It's a really interesting question. What we saw was that both crowds rose. So we say equality is a rising tide that lifts all boats. And indeed, raising the women's budget to meet the men's became, you know, headlines nationally and internationally, actually, because we were the only club in the world to do it. Would it not work? You know, this kind of thing. And what happened was, with all the publicity around that, more crowds came to the men's matches as well as to the women's. On the women's side, we were gifted, in a way, the centenary of suffrage in 2018, which meant we could encouraged people to dress as suffragettes and, you know, invited Helen Pankhurst down, had choirs singing. We had all these different things going on. And the crowds indeed quadrupled on the women's side in two seasons, the men's rising too. In terms of diversity, what we found is that on the men's side, that market, that crowd stays, you know, 90% male. On the women's side, it's about 50-50 gender-wise, and there's a different culture at women's matches. Most of the male fans that support just the men's team are very proud still of the equality campaign. So it still means something to them and you know, is part of their experience. Definitely on the women's side, we have more of a diverse and inclusive, if you like, crowd. It's so funny, Giles, honestly, what happens. Like, you know how behind the away goal, crowds will shout, you know, "You're shit" at the goalie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They still do that on the men's side, but on the women's side, they shout "mediocre." For example, right? So these cultures develop. So you keep the culture of the men's side and the kind of bants and all of that. And then on the women's side, you still get that. But it's kind of, there is a very different atmosphere. It's more, there's less anger, more joy, I'd say, although you get both and at both. Over the years, over the seasons, at first we were all hashtag one club, we're equal. What we've realized over the seasons is that equality doesn't mean the same. You know, it does not mean they have to be the same. It just means they need equal opportunity, equal respect. And that is a really, really difficult thing to do and to bring everybody along with you and do. But I think we are still on a journey with it, but it's a really interesting journey. And my goodness, have we made impact, you know, because I forgot to say, you know, the women got into the championship as a result of Equality FC. And that's the second highest tier of English women's football. And we've played Manchester United, we've played Liverpool, we've played Crystal Palace, we've played Charlton. You know, and Lewis is such a small club. We really are the mouse that roared. So we've had some amazing experiences and have now got owners in, I think, 42 countries around the world. We're very proud of everything we've done.
Amazing. It's funny because I can't speak from where you're standing. Your viewpoint is obviously significantly different to my own experience of women's football. But as a company, we've sponsored Chesham United women's team for, I think, 4 years now. The points you raise, I do recognise in terms of the attendance at the men's game versus the women's game, etc., etc. But there's a few things I'm kind of privy to or I'm aware of through my friendships with a couple of the players, especially Kate Bowers, who is a really close friend of mine, has been for years. She represents the England's deaf team and is currently recovering from, I think, her sixth ACL injury. So I'm sending love to you, Kate. The way it's almost as if like the male-dominated system is so difficult to shift, and I'm not trying to make it sound like it can't shift. Obviously, within Lewis, it has made huge grounds. But I recall them sharing a story about how hard it was to even get training facilities because even local AstroTurf pitches, and I'm talking grassroots football here, were just block booked by men's teams. So actually, there's you know, countless horrible stories of women's football teams having to travel outside of their locality and their town or their region to even train. There's so much to undo, isn't there? So it's so important to have someone shining the light and waving the flag and representing change.
100%. I mean, the thing that has always motivated me is the stories of the players, because you come across these, you know, incredible stories of obstacles and resilience that, you know, is so frustrating that these things still happen. Like, I remember our players get definitely from 2017 18 19, you know, they'd been at clubs where they'd had to clear up chicken poo off the pitch before they could play on their rubbish pitch, you know, or they'd had to say a club was being sponsored by a boot manufacturer. The men got the boots for free, but the women had to pay for them. And in some cases, weren't even allowed to buy them. They're just seen not just as second best, but really quite scum, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. They weren't marketed. There was no medical for them. You know, you talk about a player having lots of ACL injuries. And we know now through science that there are certain surfaces that are much better for women to play on, that there are times of the month when it's much more easy to hurt yourself than other times, and you need protection against that. We know that there are certain studs you should have as a woman that are much more suited to your protection of your ACL and all sorts of things than other studs. It's not, women are not just small men, is something we've learned over the seasons as well. So, you know, it's just incredible what some women have had to put up with in order to play football. It's incredible that they still play it, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I'll come back to your earlier point about it's not about having, you know, equal or equality. It's more about having the opportunity. And actually, I love, you know, I'm a huge fan of the songs of the Terraces. So to have your mediocre story is just, it's just a perfect chant that's been born out of the opportunity to have you know, women's sport well attended, you get to experience the same joys of being in the crowd.
Well, one thing we did was obviously, you know, we introduced women's football chanting workshops. They actually started in my kitchen because my friend Jamie was really, he was a man, and he'd been put off men's football by sort of toxic masculinity that was on display there. And he just came to the women's matches. And one day we were playing Aston Villa and the Villains had bought these drums. And they were chanting and making a lot of noise. And we weren't making any noise because we were all fairly new to fandom. And he said, this can't happen. So, you know, we got into my kitchen the following Saturday, ready to prepare for the Sunday. And we made chants about the rooks. And we worked out they had to be anthemic, repeatable three times, you know, do it loudly from the bottom of your chest. And, you know, for women, actually, it's a big thing. You know, you take up space, use your voice loud. It's a really... It can be a foreign thing for a lot of women to sort of shout at an oblong pitch in public when you've never done that before. Whereas a lot of men have been introduced as boys to football chanting. So it's things like that we develop, you know, through trial and error, through the actual facing these actual problems. And we developed those kind of workshops. We also developed the offside rule and all that jazz workshop, which I introduced on the board, actually. And I remember saying to the board, who were all men at the time, apart from me, I want to develop these workshops. I want people to, you know, new fans of women's football to understand what they're watching, because they come along, they don't necessarily know the rules of the game, you know. And so everyone on the board said, yeah, I'll come and explain it. I'll explain it. So then we talked about what mansplaining was and that it would actually be better to have women players explain to these new fans, you know, of the women's game that were some men, but mainly women, you know, what the offside rule was and what sort of tactics they were using, what kind of set pieces we might expect to look out for. You know, it made the game so different for these new fans because they could see it with new eyes, you know, and it was fantastic. But those evenings were fantastic, actually.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm going to share a quote from a really good friend of mine, Chris Paraos, who you may be familiar with.
Yes.
Chris says, a lot of people talk about football as being a mirror of society, but I think we have the ability to make it a leader. Football is a sport where we learn to work, play, celebrate and commiserate together. Football clubs are embedded in their communities because they make such a positive change in people's lives. I wondered how much of that point feels relevant to Lewis, because the change that you must have instigated must have been felt like far beyond the football pitch.
100%. I agree with every word of that quote. What I've always felt is that we could set an example at Lewis. No matter how small we are, we can give people hope, right? So yes, football is a mirror, but football can actually create what I call a kind of utopia that society can then follow. And because football is mainly a male bastion, really, we have therefore, using football, power over men's hearts and minds. And because we live in a patriarchy, those are the hearts and minds that we need to be accessing for change. So I think football's an amazing vehicle that you can actually use to change the world. So I completely agree with her. And yes, we know from our current COO at Lewis FC is called Kelly Lindsay, and she was once the manager for the Afghan women's team. Through her, we know that women in Afghanistan knew even about Equality FC some years back and knew that somewhere in the world, women were actually getting paid the same as men for playing football. And that gave people in countries like Afghanistan some sort of hope. We know that there are owners from Fiji to Chile to 15% of our owners are in North America. There are people for whom what we've done at Lewis has given them hope and meaning and purpose, and they are so proud to support it. More locally, we know that in Sussex, we've had, the third highest uptick of girls playing football of anywhere in the last few years. Oh, and the other great thing that we know is that when Zero, who are an amazing sponsor of women's football, when they sponsored us, they did this research to find out, you know, which was the most, what they call affinity-aware English women's team. And we were second only to the Lionesses. So we've definitely made a massive impact with Equality FC and attracted lots of financial benefit as well, because it's important to note that sometimes people think, you know, women's football's a charity case or we just do it to help. But actually, women's football has such an amazing social meaning and is such an amazing social vehicle for what it represents, that brands that get involved with it find that the storytelling aspect of it, the content aspect of it, is very useful and gets them some very loyal followers.
Yeah, brilliantly said. I bet the younger you around Wembley wouldn't believe you'd ever be saying such smart, articulate, wonderful, inspiring things about football.
Well, not at all, but I've learned so much, Giles. And, I'm very grateful to the way that Lewis FC was set up, that I could stand to be a director, and get elected, therefore have the power of setting a strategy and having the power to make decisions, because what I think is that I was able to bring, some people might say imposter, but I like to say outsider value to the board. Why couldn't I get oat milk for my tea when I can get it in Cafe Nero or Starbucks? Why not at a football ground? Why things that I knew that were important to me, why wouldn't I have art in the ground, that makes me feel welcome? Men are already welcome, or men that like football are already welcome because they're going to see football. But people like myself, who didn't at that point initially like football, might feel slightly like they don't belong there unless there are cultural references that they can relate to. And that, to me, is very, very important, because I want a girl that's 14 years old to know that she can come to the Dripping Pan, have free sanitary products, bring her own sandwich if she doesn't want to spend any money, and get in for free because she's under 16 and all under 16s go free, Lewis. So I just want girls to have easy access to watch these amazing women who show them a different way of being in the world,
Amazing. I was going to ask you what the advantages were of being an outsider, because people typically use the other word, imposter syndrome, when they feel like they're not in the right kind of environment. But I think you've just articulated it really well. I guess you just question everything, right? Because you're not familiar with what the set rules apparently are.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have that sort of questioning mindset, that curious mindset. It's a different culture. So I approached it tenuously and humbly at first, but then got cross with it, so wanted to change it. Now, the thing about imposter is really interesting, because imposter syndrome is when you feel, that you're not worth it, you're not as good as you should be. And I know a lot of people do suffer from that. But actually, in football, it's very clear that the environment makes you an imposter. If you're a woman, you're not the imposter. You don't have a syndrome, because it's making you an imposter, if that makes sense. So it's not some sort of imagined thing in your head. You kind of are. So in order to make that a valuable thing, the people around you and the context that you're operating in need to change and be accepting and open to suggestions and changes. Yeah. And then you're not an imposter anymore, and everyone can belong.
Well said, Karen. Can we quickly give a shout out to your book? Do you prefer Pitch Invasion or Bitch Invasion? Are we going Amazon or Google?
It's called Pitch Invasion. I wanted to call it Bitch Invasion, just ironically, really, because, to some people it might have felt like that. But actually, Amazon wanted to call it, that it's better, my publisher said, to call it Pitch Invasion, because Amazon don't like the word bitch too much. So we got round that by putting a sort of lipsticked bubble under the P to make it look like a B. So it's actually called Pitch Invasion, but the Pitch Invasion is my own preferred title.
Fantastic. What can our listeners expect from the book, which is available to pre-order, right? There'll be a link in this podcast listing.
It's a memoir of my time at Lewis FC and how I helped welcome unwelcome women to football, and how I helped propel Lewis FC women to the championship, and how, I stayed involved in order to get investment into the club. And we had a near miss a season or so ago with that. But, there's always hope on the horizon.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to go to listener questions. I'm going to try and squeeze two in, Karen, if we've got time. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. I'm going to start with one from Jenny, which is on topic. Jenny says, given what you achieved at Lewis FC, what are you most excited or hopeful about for the future?
Well, the rise of the women's team and women's football generally. But for Lewis, I'm really hoping that the team will be elevated by investment, because we know that the club is looking at that. And I really hope it happens. So that's what I'm excited about.
Amazing. I'm going to go to Natalie here. Natalie's referenced another club, which is kind of making waves of its own. What do you think about what's going on at Wrexham? Is it just another case of rich owners plough money into a club and win, or is there more to it?
But I think there's more to it. I think Ryan Reynolds is a very astute business person and marketer. And I think he had people looking for a club that he could invest in with a sort of Cinderella story. So he had this, he was always going to make a documentary. He's invested in Wrexham and brought this kind of left behind community, left behind football club to success with his celebrity and his money. And it's benefited him and the club hugely, because I think the Netflix documentary that he made has been hugely, you know, successful in America, where they love stories like that. Oh, we love them here. I mean, it's been brilliant. So I think, you know, he's used his popularity very well and everyone's come out winning.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Good answer. The final part of the interview then, Karen, is our four pertinent poses. What advice would you give to your younger self?
Carry on as you are, really. I mean, I don't really have regrets. I always think you can. I've always practiced Buddhism, actually, and there's a saying that you turn poison into medicine. So I always think that, you know, carry on. You can make the wrong decisions. It doesn't just make a decision. It doesn't matter if it's right or wrong, because you can always correct it. You know, you can always pivot. You can always change things and do things differently. But I would say never let a makeup artist tweak all your eyebrows out. That's bloody annoying, that is. Never do that.
I feel like there's more to unpack there.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Number two, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why? So you can choose your industry, but it would probably make sense to stick with football.
Yeah, well, you know what I really don't like? I don't like that sort of generic, cliched language that footballers use in post-match interviews. And I would like to banish that. And I would particularly like to banish it for women's football and, you know, get some really interesting answers from the women players that don't feel that they just have to parrot what the men usually say in order to be relevant to football. I really want the women's game to come into its own, and language is a really good way of doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, what do people say? It's a precursor to behaviour change, language change. It's one of those things where there's very few, and I say this to my endemise, almost entirely thinking about male footballers who I'm familiar with speaking, and there's very few characters that come across in post-match interviews. They become so sanitized, don't they, by, I guess, the PR guidelines that they're to follow.
I hate those guidelines, and I also don't like professionalization when it's done wrong, because I like people to try stuff, do stuff, get excited by stuff, keep their passion, you know. I really think those things are important to us as a human race. And football is the most popular sport in the world. So, you know, let's start there since we've got it and be ourselves.
Yeah, totally. Apart from Pitch Invasion, which, as I say, we'll link to in this listing, are there any books that you would recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, so, I mean, Pitch Invasion is actually quite funny. I forgot to tell you that, because it's like, it's all the sort of things that I got wrong. And I, you know, because I'm into sort of air kissing, but actually I learned how to do high fives. And, you know, it's like, I just made a lot of mistakes, you know, but I didn't really mind, partly because I'm a menopausal woman, right? Or now I'm postmenopausal woman. But yeah, the books I'd recommend are probably not as funny as that, but they are. I really like Why Men Win at Work by Jill Whitty Collins, because it applies to any industry, and it's about how we can all act differently, really, at work in order to achieve better outcomes and also, like, be a bit fairer to each other. And there's kind of bits at the back which are really practical, like if you're a woman, if you're a man, if you're a manager, if you're a CEO, you know, what should you do? So I really think Why Men Win at Work is a good book for anyone that's interested in this area. And then I think the book that has inspired me so much is by Virginia Woolf, who lived up the road, actually, from us in Lewis. She lived in Rodmell. She wrote A Room of One's Own, you know, saying a woman must have money and a room of her own if she is to write. but also women footballers need resources and pitches of their own, you know, in order to play. So I really think there's a lot in there that's relevant to today and football. So I'd recommend those two books.
Fantastic. Okay, well, we will link to A Room of One's Own and Why Men Win at Work. It's increasingly rare, Karen, to have books be recommended that haven't come up previously. And I believe at least one of those hasn't. I'll have to refer back to the books that Chris recommended. But I am familiar with Why Men Win at Work. We had a book that was recommended, this is probably going back about 4 or 5 years now, by a brilliant woman called Tricia Wang, who is an ethnographer. And it was a fascinating, eye-opening book about the default presets of everything from air conditioning to things that you wouldn't typically question that were set, like were at an optimal temperature for men.
Even apparently surgeons' gloves are the size for men's hands.
Wow.
You know, rather than women's hands. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah. Wow. Number four, we always dedicate every episode to someone and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest who has to give the reason why. So would you dedicate this episode?
Yes, I am going to dedicate this episode to an amazing man called Marios Christos Svantos, who is president of the Athens Women's Football Summit. And he is the most welcoming, inclusive person with that kind of Greek hospitality in his mind all the time that I've ever met. And it runs the most amazing Women's Football Summit, that if you want to go to a summit in a beautiful place with the sea, which is basically one long dinner party, then I really recommend the Athens Women's Football Summit. And Marios is just such a... He's not just an ally. He's not just a male ally. He's a male agent. So he gets things done and centers women and really wants to grow women's football and links us all up. Like, there's a global sisterhood, really, in women's football. And he links us all up. And it's amazing how the experiences are so similar in all different countries. And Marios has brought us together. So for that, I would like to dedicate this episode to him.
That's incredible. Okay, this episode is very proudly dedicated to Marios Christos Svantos. Fantastic. As a final call to action then, if you head over to this, the listing as you're listening now, listeners, you'll be able to see links to pre-order Pitch Invasion, links to both books that Karen has recommended. How can our listeners get more Karen Dobre?
Oh my goodness. Well, listen, if you read the book, you'll have almost too much Karen Dobre and you just won't want any more. But yeah, do have a look at it. If you buy it, you'll get plenty of me. You'll understand why I've done what I've done and the kind of highs and lows of the story and the kind of bittersweetness of it all, I think. And then I'm on Instagram as Karen Dobre and I'm on LinkedIn as Karen Dobre. And those are probably the best two places to find me.
Amazing. We'll include those social links too then. Well, Karen, listen, thank you so much for joining us. I've massively enjoyed this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Giles.
And finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review the pods. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email calltoaction@gasp.agency.
To action, I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try and I try.